Good evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Here are some of the stories we are covering today, Tuesday, March 10, 2020. Sudanese authorities investigate yesterday's assassination attempt on the Prime Minister. We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. Sudan's public prosecutor is investigating yesterday's assassination attempt on the life of Prime Minister Abdalla Hamdok. Sudanese Attorney General Tajel Al-Sir Al-Habir calls it a terrorist act with intention of destroying the transitional government. Michael Atit has more for VOA from Khartoum.
Sudanese Prime Minister Abdalla Hamdok narrowly survived the bombing Monday morning in Khartoum North while being driven to his office. High witnesses said the bombs targeted the Prime Minister's car. No individuals or group claimed responsibility for the attack. In a statement issued last night, Attorney General Al-Habir said the assassination attempt was an attack on the entire Sudanese government. Based on Articles 50 and 51 of the 1991 Criminal Law, the 2001 Terrorism Act, and the Weapons and Ammunitions Act of 1986, the attack constitutes a crime against the country. Al-Habir says the assassination attempt was professionally planned in terms of time and location and is vowing to track down all those involved in the incident. A combined team of police, public prosecutors, and national intelligence officers are investigating the incident. Speaking in Arabic, Sudanese Interior Minister Atarifi Idris Dafalla said officials attending an emergency meeting on the incident in Khartoum last night resolved to hunt down the perpetrators.
We condemn this criminal act which is trying to damage the name of Sudan regionally and internationally. We would want to identify the security responsibility on the incident and immediately investigate the matter and seek support of our friends to identify the attackers and present them to the Court of Justice.
Dafalla says new security and safety procedures are being put in place for the government officials. He says the attackers shall not escape the law.
We shall put in place an urgent mechanism to improve security and guarantee the safety of leaders of this country and other strategic installations. We urgently call for an immediate revision of all national legislations and laws that are linked with terrorism crimes.
Sudanese journalist and analyst Mohamed Fazari says people oppose the transitional government are trying to test the capabilities of the government and paralyze its objectives. He says it's also a message to show supporters of ousted President Omar al-Bashir are still united and strong.
It is also one of the negative signals that show that the situation is still under turmoil and they want to cut the way for the transitional period. In my point of view, this failed attempt of assassination, it has negative signals on the Sudanese political arenas and also show that the Islamists still exist and they may terrorize the situation.
Sudanese transitional government passed a law in November last year banning Bashir's National Congress Party from carrying out any political activities in the country. For VOA News, I am Michael Atit in Khartoum.
Still on Sudan, internally displaced persons living in camps northwest of Darfur say they want a semi-autonomous government. The internal displaced persons who were transported to Juba to speak to mediators of peace talks between armed groups and the Sudanese government say their own leaders can solve problems in the area. Ding Magod has more for VOA from Juba.
Darfur IDP representative Hashim Ali, who is a delegate at the peace talks, says his group presented a proposal to the delegates stating their desire to have a semi-autonomous government in Darfur. Ali says the people of Darfur believe a semi-autonomous region is best suited to address the many challenges unique to the area.
There is guns in the hand of the militia, and there is people whom they are, up to now, they are not letting people doing much kind of things. So killing women, raping, many kind of issues it is still, but we hope to be far those obstacles. We hope that this government should solve such problems, and we, at last, we need peace. I think yesterday night I was talking to someone from Kutum Doris, and an accident happened to someone. He's bringing, you know, firewood, and then they at the street, she's a lady, actually they catch her and they rape her.
40-year-old IDP Muna Ahmed, who has worked as a teacher in North Darfur State IDP camp for nearly 20 years, says she traveled to Juba to convince Sudanese leaders it's time for a leadership change in Darfur. Speaking in Arabic, Ahmed says IDPs also want the government to compensate families for everything they lost during the civil war.
For example, some families lost many members. Some lost like 17, 16, 10, and 15. We want compensation for individuals and for groups. This compensation, if it is money, it will be at least $155,000 for all IDPs.
Muna says IDPs want to return to their home villages once a peace deal is signed, but in the meantime, she says the government must ensure soldiers occupying civilians' homes are evacuated.
The woman came here to share many issues. They talked about issues not just including women, but also development and IDPs.
Safa Al-Adil, a member of the Darfur Women's IDPs Forum, says Sudanese women want a voice at the talks.
We want to remind you about the women in Western Darfur and in an IDP camp called Green Tea or Rhino. There are some human rights abuses. The abuses make some women to leave the camp and go to their own places. This issue should make the negotiators to speed up the peace talks, so with the peace we can protect our women, because whenever they want to get their basic needs, they do not feel safe.
Speaking in Arabic, Mutasim Abdul Saleh, a representative of the rebel group Revolutionary Front at the talks, says the government and armed groups are discussing the proposal to form a regional government.
We have almost agreed that Darfur should be a regional government. It just remains a few mechanisms and steps to go back to the regional system. If we reach the final decision, we will be done with the issues of the sharing of the power.
Saleh says the government and opposition groups have agreed that people suspected of committing war crimes will be tried in a special court in Darfur that specializes in issues such as genocide. He says the parties also agreed to give the people of Darfur 30% of positions in parliament and the ministries. For VOA News, I am Ding Makot in Juba.
From Juba, we take you to Cameroon, where dozens of reporters in Cameroon are calling for help after losing their jobs and in some cases their homes because of the war between separatist forces and the government. The reporters say they are constantly attacked or kidnapped for refusing to be propaganda tools for one side or the other. Moki Edwin Kinzika reports from Yaoundé.
30 Cameroonian journalists, most of them women, from the volatile northwest region, have gathered in the capital city Yaoundé to discuss the difficulties of reporting from Cameroon's crisis zones. Komi Musa, coordinator of Sister Speak 237, an NGO that convened the meeting, says she invited reporters because they need help to continue practicing their profession.
They don't have the kind of editorial support they need to tell good stories. We have a space where we provide this kind of support, and we also help them with sourcing for grants. Occasionally, we've helped with maybe transportation to go to an area and get the story that really needs to be told.
Musa says the reporters are victims of brutality and violence, and most of them are now poor because they are either out of job or can no longer work in an environment which is increasingly hostile. It's not just female journalists who are experiencing problems. Gilles Yumo of the Guardian Post newspaper says in February his equipment was seized by armed men. He says he cannot even apply for a job because his academic certificates were seized.
I've had several calls of threat, intimidation from separatist fighters because it's in such a way that nobody wants to see you report what is not in their favor. So when they got my documents, what they did was collected the documents and told me that they are going to get rid of them by burning.
Freelance journalist Mary Ngwa says she moved from Bamenda to Yaoundé due to threats from separatists.
I reported on the soldiers. That's when I received the big threat of my life. I started receiving phone calls. The guys were asking me, why didn't you report about the other people that were killed? Why did you report only about the military?
Since the separatist crisis started in 2017, journalists have complained of abuses by both the government and separatists fighting for the independence of the English-speaking areas from the majority French-speaking state. More than 24 said they have been arrested or threatened. Jude Viban, president of the Cameroon Association of English-speaking Journalists, says the military and separatists should know that reporters are not propaganda tools.
We denounce each time that a journalist is attacked. And then equally what we're trying to do is to provide some material like bulletproof jackets to help the journalists work in those areas. We're opening a lot of discussions for government forces to really understand that journalists are not in any way the enemy, but they are just doing their job.
The Cameroon government insists that it does not exert pressure on reporters, and the military has always said they do not harass reporters. Separatist groups, meanwhile, have said they will not allow anyone to stand in their path toward self-determination. Moki Edwin Kinzuka for VOA News, Yaoundé.
You are tuned to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Coming up, some South Sudanese have had their sight restored and are rejoicing. Find out what happened when we come back.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. Question today.
What do you do to conserve your energy when it is very hot outside?
I drink lots of cold water because it relaxes me. So immediately I become dehydrated or I feel hot. I take in more cold water, yes, and it makes me okay.
Well, I live around the beach, so on a hot day I just take a stroll on the shore wearing a light cloth so that I can feel the sea breeze around myself.
If it is hot, you have to make sure that you get somewhere where it is cool. You go and bathe. Those are normal things you have to do.
When I'm at my home, I undress. It is my home. I have a bedroom. My home is big. Why won't I undress?
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
South Sudan in Focus is now on WhatsApp. Send us a message on +1 202 630 8011. Tell us what's happening in your area or give us your feedback on the stories you hear on South Sudan in Focus. We look forward to hearing from you on WhatsApp. That number again, +1 202 630 8011.
You are tuned to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. It's time for our Tuesday health segment, and today we are talking about cataract operations. Eye surgeons from Juba came to Yei River County to operate more than 100 residents of the town who have cataracts. And the residents are saying they can now see again, as we hear from Daniel Friday Martin in Yei.
Dr. Malice David, an eye specialist, says his team at the Marta Healthcare Center operated on 116 patients with cataract infection this past week who have regained their vision. He says 230 more patients have been screened for surgery.
We have done our part operating, giving them back their sight. Cataract, one of the biggest causes is the age. The second is also some group of diseases like hypertension, diabetics that attributes to cataract. Then the third can also be trauma. So we always advise them to be careful with the eyes.
Dr. David says a cataract is an eye infection due to old age, misuse of drugs or physical injuries to human eyes. 84-year-old Tereja Kambra had her cataracts removed last Friday. Speaking in Kakra, she says she can now see again after being blind for 15 years.
For the last many years, I could not see anything, but today, after a medical operation on my eyes, I am now able to see the soil, human beings, and other objects around me. And I am thankful to the doctors who helped us.
73-year-old patient Daniel Modi suffered from a cataract infection for the last 4 years. He regained his sight this week after undergoing surgery at Marta Eye Health Center. Speaking in Kakwa, Modi says he is overjoyed to see clearly again after undergoing the operation.
We were told to take personal care of our eyes, and the doctor said if we don't listen to the health instructions, we will still get blind. My message to the doctors is that they should be coming to Yei frequently to help other people who are suffering from eye complications.
Charles Agele, program manager at Marta Health Center, says while the team operated on nearly 200 patients last week, there are hundreds of others in rural areas who need treatment.
There are so many people in the communities, in the villages, who may go blind. This cataract operation that has happened, it's not enough. Our appeal outside there, really, if there is anyone who can help us, because it's quite expensive. We cannot stand alone as Marta to organize for cataract camp. Even cataract, if it's not operated quickly, it can lead someone to blindness, because we want a productive community. A productive community to have a bright side.
The one-week mobile eye operation was conducted by eye specialists from Juba and funded by well wishers of the Episcopal Church based in the United Kingdom. Dr. James Wani, former Director General of the now defunct Yei River State Health Ministry, says cataracts are a serious health problem here.
I'm concerned because it's a public health concern, number one. Number two, you know, eye is very sensitive. So I'm just urging whoever has problem with eye, let him just come to the hospital. Because we have announced on the radio that people who are having problems with eye, let them come to the hospital, and our team did a good job.
Dr. Wani has asked for more support from the national government and its international partners to help the more vulnerable members of society. In Yei Central Equatorial State, for VOA News, I'm Daniel Friday Martin. For VOA News, I'm Daniel Friday Martin in Yei Central Equatorial State.
Still on health matters, Nigeria's health authorities are intensifying efforts to contain the coronavirus after the West African nation announced its first case. Part of Nigeria's readiness includes upgrading testing labs, conducting screening at entry points, and developing public awareness campaigns. Timothy Obiezu reports from Abuja.
A national reference laboratory located in the Gadua area of Nigeria's capital, Abuja, is one of five set up across Nigeria by the Nigerian Center for Disease Control, NCDC, to test for the coronavirus. Lab manager Akinpelu Afolabi says Nigeria's only confirmed case of the coronavirus was discovered here.
So far, of all the samples, 13 samples we've tested, it was that one that was positive. We tested here too and tested in Lagos. And that is the one that we discovered that was positive. They are managing the person in Lagos now.
Nigeria is one of only three African countries capable of testing the coronavirus in real time. Afolabi says health authorities and officials of the Nigeria's Disease Control Center have prepared many weeks ahead.
We saw the equipment we have and see the people when they are working and see that they have what it takes in terms of human resources, in terms of equipment. You see that we have it.
Nigerian authorities say it was an Italian man from Milan, a city badly hit by the coronavirus, who was the first confirmed case of the virus in sub-Saharan Africa. The World Health Organization in February named Nigeria among 12 countries in Africa at high risk of people contracting the virus. Authorities have responded by activating emergency operations, including public health awareness campaigns and heightened surveillance at entry points like the airport. Wando Mba is a director of the National Center for Disease Control.
At the point of entry, we have mounted a lot of activities. I mean, enlightening people, checking people, getting information from them, and then at the same time comparing whatever information we are getting with what they are saying. Because a lot of people tell lies.
With more than 95,000 coronavirus cases around the world and some 3,300 deaths, Nigerians are worried about the spreading virus, even though authorities are urging citizens to remain calm. Timothy Obiezu for VOA News, Abuja.
Women make up half of the world's population, but a recent study showed that corporations spend just 1% of their funds for acquisition specifically on women-owned businesses. A Washington-based nonprofit is trying to change that and says supporting women-owned businesses has positive social effects. VOA's Anita Powell has the story for VOA from Johannesburg.
Chef Malemo Virtuosa came up through the male-dominated industry of high-end cooking. She was one of only a few female chefs at some of the nation's top hotels before starting her own catering business. Despite her best efforts, her business suffers from something she can't control: sexism. Although sub-Saharan Africa has some of the world's highest rates of female entrepreneurship, businesswomen often struggle to get financing and build support networks. For Chef Mo, as she prefers to be called, pressure in the kitchen pressured her to hide away.
So when servers become so busy, they really push you out the way because they don't think that you can push as quick as they can, you know, and take out the food as quick as they can as well. I think that's why I also decided on becoming a pastry chef and not just being skilled in the food, you know, high-end dining, you know, fine dining and all of that. Because I think with the pastries, I was able to just hide away from all these males and do my pretty work, you know, without them being in my face.
Nonprofit We Connect International is trying to bring businesswomen to the forefront by linking women-owned businesses to qualified buyers and running educational seminars for women entrepreneurs. This is CEO Elizabeth Vasquez.
Women represent a third of the world's private businesses. They're half the population. They make or influence over 75% of all purchasing decisions. We need women and men to be in our value chains. We need them to step up and deliver solutions to the problems that we all faced. And women are uniquely qualified because of their life experience to provide solutions that right now we don't have access to.
And says business owner Belukazi Nkala, women entrepreneurs often find solutions that have long been ignored by their male counterparts. Her company designs work clothing for women engineers, miners, and factory workers. It's not about just aesthetics, she says, but safety.
The one thing that I've noticed is, especially with women, we tend to, everything about the workwear tends to be oversized because we're trying to compensate for one part of our body or another. So it's important that from a safety element, it has to fit properly to be able to be in an environment. For example, in mining, you can't be caught onto something and, you know, something could happen, which could obviously be a safety issue or something hazardous that could happen at work.
For Chef Mo, investing in women is just good business sense.
We're able to run households. I mean, honestly speaking, you get home and you make sure that there's dinner cooked at a certain time. You make sure that the kids are well fed, the kids are bathed, you know, they're sleeping and whatnot. If I'm able to manage a household after a full day of work, how can you now exclude me from a business?
But she doesn't want your business just because she's a woman. Instead, she says, look for proof of her virtuosity in her pizza. Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
From Southern Africa, we go to North Africa, where French President Emmanuel Macron met yesterday with General Khalifa Haftar, commander of the Libyan National Army. Haftar reportedly agreed to sign a ceasefire agreement, but said he would withdraw if it's violated by the Tripoli-based UN-recognized government. Renan Smith, managing editor of the London-based Libya Analysis, says several countries backing rival factions have violated the embargo.
But we have to remember that Haftar has a long history of agreeing in principle with his international allies that he is going to agree to a ceasefire or a new political process, and then a few days later either reneging on his commitment or just not following through and not implementing the action on the ground. We've seen this with Russia most recently, the ceasefire at the beginning of the year, but also the UAE and France a couple of years ago when they tried to enforce a political solution. So I wouldn't read too much into this statement by Haftar that he intends to agree to the ceasefire. There is a draft ceasefire agreement on the table, but there are no indications from either side really that they're willing to really push ahead with the negotiations needed to implement that. And I think the fact that, given the condition that it requires the GNA aligned militias to agree to the ceasefire, he's also said he still won't meet with the president of the GNA, Fayez Sarraj. I think these are all signs that are kind of a get out clause for Haftar, that he can easily say, well, I was willing to agree to the ceasefire, but the opposing forces did this or they did a violation and therefore I'm not going to agree to it. So in short, I don't think that this meeting is going to lead to any meaningful changes on the ground or any implementation of a permanent ceasefire in the short term.
Macron and Haftar discussed also the intervention of foreign nations in the Libya conflict after world leaders agreed in Berlin in January to end all foreign interference and uphold weapons embargo. Several countries backing rival factions in Libya have violated UN arms embargo, and the UN denounced them without naming countries. How do you explain the inability of the European Union to enforce the UN arms embargo in Libya?
In order to enforce the UN arms embargo, you need three key things, I would say. You need a mechanism for reporting what the violations are. You need a way of then punishing or implementing punitive action against those who have violated it. And then also an active policing element, so to actually stop the arms from getting to Libya in the first place, rather than just punishing those who import them after that. Now, the first part is ongoing, so the UN Sanctions Committee is frequently reporting in detail on who these actors are. But the reason we don't have that second step, which is the punitive action, is that the UN Security Council just is unable to enforce the embargo in or sanctions in any sense, because there is not the political will. There is too much division within the UN, too many different relationships going on, and they're just not willing to take that move. Now, the final action, which is the kind of actually stopping the arms from getting to Libya in the first place, whether by sea, by air, or by ground, this is what the EU recently has said they are going to try and enforce. Now, while they may be able to do that to some extent in the Mediterranean at sea, this requires a huge amount of investment, resources, and not only boats, but aeroplanes, ground forces to actually enforce this. And therefore, again, there aren't really the resources, there isn't really the political will to do this. And this means that really the arms embargo is difficult to enforce, even though all these countries are saying in theory they commit to it.
Some experts said the resignation of the UN envoy to Libya may open the door for a new political agreement to replace Sokhairat's UN-sponsored agreement that was not adhered to. Do you agree?
I think the departure of Salame will certainly leave a big question mark over what happens next.
That's VOA senior analyst Muhammad Al-Ashinawi speaking to Renan Smith, managing editor of the London-based Libyan Analysis. And that brings us to the end of our show for this Tuesday. We now leave you with the music Doni Doni by Osmanis from Cote d'Ivoire.
C'est ça la life, on est ensemble, ou bien Krikata, Krikata, Krikata. Yampo en oi.
You've been listening to Osmanis from Cote d'Ivoire with the song Doni Doni. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Thanks for inviting us into your vehicles and homes. Please join us again tomorrow evening for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.